but just before we headed back to our car in defeat, several adults in the crowd began buzzing. One of them pointed at a thin young man quickly crossing the street. He had thick, tasseled black hair and wore Buddy Holly-style glasses. "That's Larry McMurtry," a woman exclaimed. Seeing the baffled looks on our faces, she explained that McMurtry was an Archer City rancher's son and had written the novel on which the movie was based. "Hey, Larry!" someone else yelled. McMurtry turned and gave us a brief wave. I was amazed. I had no idea that a writer could be famous. I went home, came across a worn-out paperback edition of The Last Picture Show, and devoured it. I was floored by the characters McMurtry had created, who were just like people I knew in real life. They talked the same way. They had the same problems. They stood around on Friday nights trying to think of something to do to entertain themselves. And most incredible was the fact that the novel about Archer City, Texas, of all places, was being hailed as a major work of literature. By college, I was an unabashed McMurtry fanboy. I wrote papers about him for my English classes, in which I always pointed out that he and I were, more or less, neighbors. During my trips back to Wichita Falls, I made regular excursions to Archer City, hoping to run into him. In my early 20s, I decided to compose my own McMurtryan novel about a boy coming of age in rural Texas. How hard could it be? I asked, leafing through The Last Picture Show for the 100th time. After learning that McMurtry wrote 5 double-spaced pages of fiction on his manual typewriter every day of the week, just after breakfast, I vowed that I would do the very same thing each morning before going off to my job as a reporter at a Dallas newspaper. I never got past the second chapter. How, I wonder, did McMurtry do it? McMurtry, who was 84, died on Thursday of congestive heart failure, as his writing partner, Diana Ossana, confirmed. He spent his final days surrounded by Ossana, her daughter, Sarah, his wife, Faye Kesey, his son, James, his grandson, Curtis, and Ossana's 3 dogs, all of whom adored McMurtry. Just before he died, Ossana sent me an email. I keep walking through my house and remembering so many things he did, where he'd sit, typing at the counter, staring out at the mountains for hours at a time, she wrote. I know I'll survive, but at the same time, I don't know how I'll survive. This feels like someone is sawing off one of my limbs. McMurtry was not always the friendliest man. In 2016, when I visited him in Tucson and Archer City for a Texas Monthly story I was writing, he always seemed bored and changed the subject whenever I asked him about his accomplishments. He grunted at my queries about his writing process. When I called him to ask follow-up questions, he got so tired of talking with me that he hung up the phone without saying goodbye. Not once did I ever hear him laugh out loud. But Lord, he was a lot of fun to be around. At dinners, he'd get wound up and talk about everything from 18th century Russian poetry to the joys of Dr. Pepper and Fritos. He passed on juicy gossip about movie directors, politicians, and best-selling authors. I felt cheated when he said it was time for me to leave because, of course, he had to get up early the next morning to write. Day after day, he churned out the pages. The Archer City boy who grew up in a ranch house with no books turned out to be one of the most prolific writers in American letters. He published some 30 novels and 14 books of nonfiction, wrote or co-wrote more than 40 screenplays and teleplays, and produced reams of book reviews, magazine essays, and forewords to other texts. Larry is like an old cowboy who has to get up in the morning and do some chores, Ossana told me in 2016. He has to get up and write. I don't think he would know what to do with himself if he didn't have something to write. I haven't come close to reading all of McMurtry's work. The only person I know who's accomplished that Herculean task is Martin Busby, an English professor at Texas State University. Busby argues that McMurtry, more than anyone else, has shaped the way people see Texas. His novels about fictional town of Thalia, Duane's Depressed, Horsemen Pass By, The Last Picture Show, and Texasville, among others, are pitch-perfect depictions of the realities and hilarities of small-town Texas life. When we spoke in 2016, Busby went so far as to compare the Thalia novels to William Faulkner's great Southern novels about Yoknapatawpha County. And the novels McMurtry wrote in the 70s about Houston, including All My Friends Are Going to Be Strangers and Terms of Endearment, are, in Busby's words, brilliant and moving domestic dramas, something that no one was expecting from him. And then there's Lonesome Dove, his 1985 novel about two retired Texas Rangers leading a brutal cattle drive from Texas to Montana in the 1870s. McMurtry had spent years railing against writers who produced cliched novels about the Old West. He swore he would never stoop to writing a Western. But he did, and the novel he produced gripped the public's imagination. Lonesome Dove won the Pulitzer Prize and sold nearly 300,000 copies in hardcover and more than 1 million copies in paperback. It spawned a sequel as well as prequels and became one of the most popular miniseries of all time, starring Tommy Lee Jones and Robert Duvall. To Texans, went one joke, Lonesome Dove was the third most important book in publishing history, right behind the Bible and the Warren Commission report. Even when McMurtry was writing novels set in Los Angeles or Las Vegas or Washington, D.C., Texans were always a part of the narrative. He wrote of a former rodeo cowboy who became a womanizing antiques dealer, Cadillac Jack, and an erstwhile University of Texas football player who later became a Hollywood striver, somebody's darling. Just before he fell ill, he was working on two more Texas-based stories, one a Western based on the life of the cattleman Charles Goodnight, and the other a modern-day novel of manners about a Fort Worth socialite. He never published them. For all of the acerbic criticism of mundane Texas life and literature that marked his essays, the man loved Texans, big and small. McMurtry took his knocks for writing too much and not editing what he had written. But even his fiercest critics admitted that he had a Dickensian ability to spin a yarn. Besides the Pulitzer, he won an Academy Award with Osana in 2006 for Brokeback Mountain, their adapted screenplay based on Annie Proulx's story about two gay ranch hands. McMurtry famously wore blue jeans to the ceremony and had a less than ecstatic response while accepting the Oscar. When he wasn't writing, he served as the president of PEN America, the Association of Prominent Writers. He operated a massive secondhand bookstore that, at its peak, spread across four buildings in downtown Archer City. Periodically, this is one of my favorite details about him, he'd rent a Lincoln Continental, drive across the country, visit a friend or two, drop off the car at a rental facility whenever he got tired of driving, pay the exorbitant drop-off charge, and then fly home. I asked him what he did with all his dirty clothes on those excursions. Would he stop at a laundromat and clean them? Oh, hell no, he said. He'd stuff the clothes in a Federal Express box and ship them back to his house. When I went to see him in 2016, he seemed weary. He had had a couple of heart attacks. He stumbled a few times. His memory slipped. Old age comes on apace to ravage all the climb, he said at one point. quoting the 18th century Scottish poet James Beattie, and old age is doing what it can to ravage me. I tried to get McMurtry to reflect on the end of his life. I asked him how he felt about the inevitable day that was approaching when he would no longer be around to write his 5 pages, but he was having none of it. I changed the subject slightly and asked where he wanted to be buried. He said he had bought a plot at a Wichita Falls cemetery, but he recently had begun thinking about cremation and keeping his ashes in an urn. I expect there will be a little memorial service of some kind, and then my ashes will be placed unobtrusively on the shelf in one of the bookstores in Archer City, he said. Your ashes forever among books? I asked, hoping my question might spur McMurtry to say something sentimental. Predictably, he refused to rise to the bait. Well, he said, maybe people will come up to Archer City and stare at my urn, and maybe they'll buy more books.
Hello, this is Michael, reading for Texas Monthly Archives. The Culture, Return of the Native Son. In his life and in his fiction, Larry McMurtry has come back home. By Jan Reed, published February 1993. 20 years ago, Larry McMurtry, the preeminent chronicler of Texas, was estranged and far removed from the state. He had moved in 1969 to Washington, D.C., and opened a rare bookshop. With his son James, he lived in a pretty little town across the border in Virginia and kept a small apartment above the store. He wrote that he returned one summer to see if he still knew or felt anything about Texas, and essentially decided, nope. Yet McMurtry had made his early mark with books that elegized the most revered Texas icon, the working cowboy. He knew the life firsthand. His grandfather began ranching Archer County's Blue Stem Prairie soon after the defeat of the Comanche and Kiowa made that practical. Most of the patriarch's 12 children scattered into the panhandle. In time, the clan owned 150,000 acres. McMurtry's dad grazed cattle on 5,000 acres of land around Archer City. He was a wiry, driven man, hard to please and averse to nonsense. McMurtry grew up mending fence, talking to cowhands, daubing cattle sores with a foul disinfectant called screwworm dope. His role models were terse, grizzled uncles, who equated horsemanship skills with strength of character. But from the start, McMurtry was a townsman too. His mother didn't want to raise a family in that lonesome ranch house stuck between a dirt road and a humpbacked knoll called Idiot Ridge. Though McMurtry's imagination roved the pasture land, he spent more hours of his youth in a small white frame house in Archer City, a bleak and windswept burg near Wichita Falls. For most of his adult life, Larry McMurtry fought those roots the way that area ranchers grub out pestilent mesquites. He chopped, yanked, and poured more than a little poison into the soil. McMurtry ran from Texas, and perhaps himself, even as he became the dominant Texas writer of his time, or any other time. He used to wear a t-shirt that read, Minor Regional Novelist. It was an academic tic, this preoccupation with labels of major and minor, but his talent was large. So was his ego and the chip on his shoulder. He came, he often remarked, from a bookless town in a bookless part of the state that had no literature of any worth. Texas themes and Texas settings, he contended, could be gravely injurious to a novelist's career. Still, he found ways to write about his region's agrarian past and urban redirection that were moving, dramatic, and new. Since the early 60s, McMurtry has published 17 books. Lonesome Dove, his masterpiece, won the Pulitzer Prize in 1986. He has informed a generation of reading Texans about themselves, and his professional success has legitimized Texas in a literary sense. As a 23-year-old, McMurphy drafted two novels, Horsemen Pass By, 1961, and Leaving Cheyenne, 1962, that handsomely debunked the Western genre of Zane Grey and Louis L'Amour. All the Indians in North Texas had been chased off to Oklahoma, and guns were just ranching tools carried about in pickup trucks. Horses and saddles were still required in order to do the work, but the new prestige item was a Cadillac. The 20th century had reduced the ranching West to a grim essence of trying to make money. Working cowboys were a tragic dying breed. Their entrapment by the myths and traditions of the past made them all the sadder. The first book was promptly made into the film HUD, with a mesmerizing Paul Newman and the anti-heroic title role. Though Hollywood later made shambles of Leaving Cheyenne, it was the stronger novel. As the years wore on, its author would grouse about its enduring popularity. Only the very young or the hopelessly romantic, he held, could buy its premise. Two men could love and sleep with the same woman all their lives, yet their friendship would never really suffer. Good point. But Leaving Cheyenne holds up as one of his three best novels because of the loveliness of the prose, the tartness of the dialogue, and the staying power of the characters. In that book, he discovered his gift for humor. In the same vein, a much-praised essay, Take My Saddle from the Wall, A Benediction, appeared in the 1968 collection In a Narrow Grave. He wrote about his family elders, especially an Uncle Johnny, who rode off to work the great vast spreads of the Panhandle, went broke running his own ranch, started another, lived to drive a Cadillac, and in the end, was so arthritic from getting thrown and fallen on by horses that he had to order his cowboys to fix him in the saddle with baling wire. McMurtry's dad could never understand why his son also had to write about his Uncle Johnny's contraction of venereal disease. To tell the whole story, McMurtry tried to explain. He lived in Houston from 1963 to 1969. At Rice, he was an English graduate student and a teacher of writing, and while managing a shop called The Bookman, he refined another great passion, finding, collecting, and dealing in rare books. He didn't encourage his students much. In fact, he discouraged them. What he did was show them the life, the possibility. Success could happen. He hosted the merry prankster busloads of Ken Kesey, a chum from their Wallace Stegner fellowship days at Stanford. Kesey wrote on One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, McMurtry on Leaving Cheyenne. He hosted the merry prankster busloads of Ken Kesey, a chum from their Wallace Stegner fellowship days at Stanford. Kesey worked on One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, McMurtry on Leaving Cheyenne. Tom Wolfe wrote about Kesey and McMurtry's friendship in his chronicle of the 60s, The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test. McMurtry was special, and he knew it. In 1972, one of his screenplays, written in collaboration with director Peter Bogdanovich, was nominated for an Academy Award. McMurtry had blazed through his third novel, from which the script was drawn, following a return to Archer City on a family matter. 3 days there reminded him of everything about the town he didn't like. He described a place where teenagers sodomized heifers, where married women had never heard of orgasm, where a preacher's son sexually abused a 5-year-old child. The last picture show, the author all but sneered, is lovingly dedicated to my hometown. McMurtry has never consented to interviews by journalists. He did not grant one to me, but he has responded to scholars' inquiries, and in his essays, he hardly shies away from the subject of himself. When the movie was playing to great acclaim, he wrote ruefully in a Washington, D.C. journal, "By the time the book was published, 1966, I was aware it was too bitter. Archer City had not been cruel to me, only, honestly, indifferent, and my handling of my characters in my book represented a failure of generosity for which I could blame no one but myself. The book had caused no great stir, even in Archer City. In hardback, it sold only about 900 copies. The movie production pumped money into a long-suffering economy, but the subject matter was touchy, and a number of the movie folk behaved as if they were brought up in Babylon. In the local backlash, some nasty comments were directed at McMurtry. In a 1975 essay for The Atlantic, McMurtry explained his movie from home. I got tired of dealing creatively with the kind of mental and emotive inarticulateness that I found in Texas. He faulted the state for its excess of Oldsmobiles. I work in Georgetown, he wrote smugly, where I am surrounded by Mercedes and Volvos. McMurtry as a yuppie and East Coast snob. A youthful marriage had left McMurtry seared, with a son in diapers to raise, and much of that pain was absorbed in Austin. He took a swipe at that dismal town and its endless production of third-rate books, movies, pictures. I don't believe it can claim a single first-rate artistic talent in any art. In Austin, an inescapable victim of rant, was McMurtry's friend Bill Brammer, who knew he had squandered a large talent, but also knew he had written an exceptional political novel, The Gay Place. Larry didn't seem at all that miserable when we were living in the same house, said Brammer, hurt by the snub. 2 years later, Brammer was dead, and McMurtry later dedicated a book to his memory. With son James grown, McMurtry embarked upon a nomadic phase, roving between apartments in Washington, D.C., Arizona, and California. He hasn't owned a car in 2 decades. He would present his American Express card at the desks of the Hertz Company, choosing not a Mercedes, Volvo, or Oldsmobile, rather a Cadillac or Lincoln. McMurtry as a fat cat nouveau riche. He would park them for days with the meter running, instruct the Hertz folks to get him a new one when the floorboard got trashy. By the early 80s, he no longer avoided Texas so much. He opened bookstores in Dallas and Houston, and his dad had died a few years earlier, so his family had need of him in Archer County. So he added to his way stations the small ranch house on Idiot Ridge. But Texas had vanished from his published fiction. He wrote inferior novels, variously set in Hollywood, Washington, D.C., and Las Vegas. If rootlessness was the disorder, it was not the most glaring symptom. McMurtry had made his youthful mark as a meticulous stylist. Commercial success allowed him to dispense with careful revision and polished turns of phrase. In middle age, he churned out books that were sloppy. During that period, the film adaptation of his Houston novel, Terms of Endearment, won a batch of Oscars. But McMurtry was at the lowest point of his career. He seemed to have lost confidence in his abilities, and he admitted that he had spent a decade writing books he didn't like. In 1981, McMurtry expounded on the sorry state of Texas in letters to Ronnie Duggar, the founding editor of the Texas Observer. McMurtry's resulting Observer essay, Ever a Bridegroom, set off an amusing furor. Not only were Texas writers ignorant of urban complexity and hung up on the frontier past, they were lazy. John Graves likes to farm. William Humphrey likes to fish. Our best writer's approach to art is tentative and intermittent. Half-assed, to put it bluntly. Instead of an infinite capacity for taking pains, they develop an infinite capacity for avoiding work and employing their creativity mainly to convince themselves that they are working well, when in fact they are hardly working at all. Until Texas writers are willing to work harder, inform themselves more broadly, and stop looking only backward, we won't have a literature of any interest. It was McMurtry's most endearing joke on himself. Political cartoonist Ben Sargent provided the art for the Observer essay. The title page had three old codgers sitting on a fence, clad in chaps, one twirling a lariat, another wearing a Texas Ranger badge, under the heading Wild West Show. The intended caricatures were McMurtry's longtime backward-looking whipping boys, the late J. Frank Dobie, Roy Betacek, and Walter Prescott Webb. But Sargent's cartoon provided Texas literature with a prescient glimpse of three other aging Texas Rangers, Gus McCrae, Colonel Call, and Jake Spoon. Soon after the Observer flap, McMurtry returned to an unproduced film scenario he had written with Peter Bogdanovich in 1972. His novelization of that material became the Wild West classic, Lonesome Dove. The plot concerned the decision of three old-timers to drive a herd of longhorns from the Rio Grande to Montana, and their loves and adventures along the way. McMurtry plucked much material from an oral history, The Trail Drivers of Texas, and J. Evett Haley's biography of Charles Goodnight. I wished he had strayed further from his historical sources. Like McMurtry's Gus McCrae, Charles Goodnight's friend and partner, Oliver Loving, was wounded in an Indian fight, lost a limb, and died from gangrene. Like the book's evil renegade, Blue Duck, the Kiowa chief Satanta cheated his captors with a suicidal headfirst leap out of a prison window. I wanted the final satisfying confrontation between Gus and Blue Duck that McMurtry seemed to promise, but the book had the emotive power of an avalanche. His characters, male and female, were irresistible. Robert Duvall, the superb actor who starred in the TV miniseries, has said that for him, the role of Gus McCrae was as classic and rewarding as the role of King Lear. Coming at a time, 1985, when the dominant Texas faith, making money off oil and land speculation, had swamped the bankruptcy courts, McMurtry's book and its success reaffirmed our more appealing myths, tradition, and pride. Literature is a judgment safely rendered generations down the line. But among Texas writers, word of his Pulitzer Prize buzzed and jangled like frontier telegraph lines. A member of the ranks had reached deep and gotten the great book within him, and the world paid heed. I had the pleasure of carrying the news to one small group. We were fishing. Arriving in camp, I said, "McMurtry won the Pulitzer." Leon Hale, a fine Houston writer, had the perfect, inarticulate Texas response. He dropped his jaw, grinned, and said slowly, "No shit." John Graves, McMurtry's longtime friend and fellow elegist, released a pleased chortle and walked off toward the river, unlimbering his fly rod. At peace with Texas in his writing, McMurtry gradually returned in his way of life. Though he kept the small apartment in Washington, he moved his most prized possession, his personal book collection, back to the ranch house on Idiot Ridge. In 1987, just off Archer City's downtown square, he opened the Blue Pig Bookshop. The store is managed by his lively sister, Sue Dean, a former rodeo queen and quasi-hippie and a lifelong horsewoman. McMurtry's other sister, Judy McLemore, owns Archer City's real estate title company. His brother Charlie is an English graduate student in Denton. His mother lives in a retirement home in Wichita Falls. Family seems to be the strongest tie. McMurtry is 30 now, a promising Austin songwriter and recording artist. James McMurtry is 30 now, a promising Austin songwriter and recording artist. James's two-year-old son, Curtis, is Grandpa's pride and joy. McMurtry worked well at the ranch, but found the rural telephone service wanting. In 1989, he bought Archer City's only mansion, just down the street from the white frame house where he grew up. When he was a boy, the mansion belonged to an eccentric oil man and rancher named Taylor. Neighborhood kids tormented old man Taylor, a sort of local Boo Radley, but McMurtry also sought him out. The old man gave him books. After the Taylors died, the yellow brick mansion became the Archer City Country Club. The town found it had scant use for such a thing, especially when the price of oil hit $8 a barrel. So at 52, McMurtry established primary residence back on the street where he started, in the biggest house in town. The golf course remains squeezed close around the mansion's fences. Nobody is yet calling him Boo Radley, but Archer City is an odd place for the rich and famous author to settle down. Empty stores, wan antique shops, and oil field winch trucks abound. The old picture show is a crumbling ruin on the courthouse square. During the mansion's restoration, he spent much of his time in Manhattan, serving as president of the American chapter of PEN, P-E-N, an organization dedicated to freedom of expression. His election to that post was emblematic of his acceptance and esteem. He was the first non-New Yorker president of PEN since the 20s. 20-odd years ago, McMurtry considered Texas origins a yoke around his neck. Slowly before he left the state, he wrote that if a Texas author could explain the Kennedy assassination and get LBJ impeached, the New York literary establishment would beat a path to his door. He might even get to meet the glamorous intellectual Susan Sontag. That statement bristled with youthful ambition and insecurity. Now a Texas pedigree can open doors for young writers, and Susan Sontag, who preceded him as president of PEN, is one of the many fascinating female friends who come to Archer City for stays in the guest rooms of his mansion. Over the years, other famous friends have included Native American writer Leslie Silko and actresses Sybil Shepherd and Diane Keaton. His newest frequent companion is a student, a former legal services executive from Tucson, Arizona. Another close friend, Texas writer Beverly Lowry, thinks his reputation for writing knowingly and well about women is deserved, and she offers an explanation. "I'd never known a man who talked about the emotional life, about falling in love, so openly and with such self-deprecating humor. I had barely met him. I was startled by it, but also comforted and very comfortable. You just don't expect that, especially in a guy from the Southwest." Since Lonesome Dove, the strongest and most revealing of his five books has been Some Can Whistle, 1989. It featured a wealthy 50-ish writer who is set up in eccentric isolation at a place like Idiot Ridge, beset with fears of self-parody, haunted but also assuaged by love's long past, bewitched by a young grandchild, annoyed by all this nagging talk about fatty diet and cholesterol. McMurtry had heart surgery last year, and the months of convalescence laid him low. A couple who retired to Archer City from the oil patch run a nice little restaurant called The Cottage Tea and Antiques. They still send over covered dishes, making sure he eats right. The restored mansion is filled with one-piece furniture and endless shelves of books. Also, there's a bone room of animal skulls, femurs, a table made from bones. They came, perforce, with a book collection acquired in Philadelphia. He dislikes air conditioning, which he calls homogenized air. His powers of concentration are legendary. Friends recall him hard at work, getting in his daily five pages, with an infant son balanced on his knee. Now he finds himself drawn to stories about people who are getting on in years. Cranky sequels, discoveries anew. Golf balls clear the privacy fence from time to time, ricochet off the roof, roll across the lawn. When McMurtry's working well, he probably doesn't notice.
So long, little doggies. 1890, the era of the great trail drives ends. By Larry McMurtry, January 1986, Texas Monthly. The importance of the trail drives, vast enough commercially, was no less vast psychologically. In Texas, in the last half of the 19th century, cattle were what oil was to become in the first half of the 20th, a seemingly infinite resource that quickly bred not merely fortunes, but also imagery and identity, though in the realm of the image, oil has never been able to compete with cattle. One reason so many oil men become cattlemen manqués. Within 10 years of its inception, the cattle trade had established an appealing and enduring body of imagery and provided Texans as a people with a reputation for dash and extravagance that they cherish to this day. Before cattle began to spill out of Texas, what were we to the nation? Commercially, a minor adjunct to the Cotton Kingdom. Politically and psychologically, the American equivalent of the Balkans. The violent animosities that Serbs and Croatians took centuries to refine were, like so much else, spontaneous developments in Texas. Freebooters had only to arrive within our much disputed borders to become patriots and freedom fighters. They swarmed in like Turks and quickly wrenched the whole state loose from the Indians and the Mexicans. When the dust of what was comparatively a short conflict settled, it was found that cattle were swarming even more prodigally than freebooters in the southern part of what had become the state of Texas. One of the marvels of American commerce is the rapidity with which certain industries mature. Computers provide an example from our own day. The home computer business became the behemoth that it is in less time than it takes to wear out a good adding machine. Technologically, the oil business has a fairly slow gestation, but its myth, by which I mean its power to seize and hold the public's imagination, was established in an afternoon at Spindletop. Wells are rarely allowed to gush nowadays, but the image of the gusher is still the most potent the oil industry has produced. Its undiminished power can be seen in the recent Russian film Siberiade, whose final sequence recalls Boomtown and many other movies on the same subject. The cattle trade flowered no less suddenly. No one knows how many cattle ran free in South Texas at the time of annexation, but by the 1860s their numbers had swelled to between 3 and 4 million, a free resource waiting to be exploited. Despite that extraordinary abundance of product, the beginnings of trail driving as a marketing practice were casual and intermittent. Markets existed, and the early cattlemen knew it. But the markets were very far away, and the routes to them rich in hazard. The arrival of either beasts or masters could not be guaranteed. Nonetheless, a few proto-Texans made drives in the 1840s. One or two headed for Illinois, but the most reachable markets then were New Orleans and Mobile. Mosquitoes lay thick along the Gulf trails, and many coastal cattlemen preferred to ship from Matagorda Bay rather than drive overland. Shipping is a term still in use in the cattle business, though what is usually described nowadays is the movement of cattle by truck from pasture to feedlot. Certain early drovers, keen for profit, considered no market on the continent beyond the reach of their beeves. Tom Candy Ponting and Washington Malone drove a herd of longhorns to Muncie, Indiana, where boxcars were secured. In 1854, the cattle were taken to Manhattan, driven through the streets, and sold at the 100th Street Market, New Yorkers, unflappable even then, seemed to regard the presence of Texas Longhorns in their boulevards as nothing to get excited about. More remarkable still were the first drives to California. As soon as word of the gold rush reached Texas, a man named W. H. Snyder, excited by the thought of all the beefsteak a state full of rich miners could consume, made up a herd and set off at once for San Francisco. He reached it a couple of years later, having decided to go north along the Rio Grande to the Continental Divide before turning west. At about the same time, Jack Curitan crossed a herd along the more difficult southern route. The Apache were not then so angry as they were to become, but the desert was the real problem with the southern route. Rafael Pompelli, one of the keenest observers to travel the border country of Arizona, left a vivid description of the cattle corpses he passed on a trip through the Sonoran Desert a little more than a decade after Curitan's drive. The routes over these wastes are marked by countless skeletons of cattle, horses, and sheep, and the traveler passes thousands of the carcasses of these animals, wholly preserved in the intensely dry air. Many of them dead, perhaps for years, had been placed upright on their feet by previous travelers. As we wound in places through groups of these mummies, they seemed sentinels guarding the Valley of Death. Little wonder that the southern route never became really popular, though Curitan was by no means the only cattleman to attempt it. The drives of the 1840s and 50s were false starts. The markets existed, and the cattle existed, but the difficulty of getting the latter to the former across such distances was evidently discouraging. 2 years on the trail could exhaust an entrepreneur sufficiently to make him seek less arduous sources of profit. The energies were gathering, but conditions were not ripe. The country was still unsettled, and many of the bolder spirits who were to become pillars of the new industry, Charles Goodnight, for example, had their hands full fighting Indians, clearing out bandits, and generally making the country safe for the settled folk with whom they had so little in common. The Comanche resistance lasted a good deal longer than anyone expected it to, and before it was blunted, the Civil War came, a terrible, exhausting war. The drain on human resources was so great that one might expect that a generation would have been required for full recovery. But the American temper was evidently at its most resilient then. The guns had scarcely fallen silent before the robber barons got to work. At the same moment when veterans of the conflict were still straggling home, a flood of Texas cattle began to flow north, initially to Sedalia, Missouri. But Missouri didn't really welcome the trampling herds. Drovers were attacked and harassed by vigilantes. Baxter Springs, Kansas proved not much better, and the much-advertised threat of Texas fever did nothing to improve the situation for cattlemen. At that point, Joseph McCoy, an aggressive buyer for Chicago packing interests, mounted a strong lobbying campaign in Abilene, Kansas, a community easily reachable from Texas along a trail that had been worked out a few years earlier by the Cherokee trader named Jesse Chisholm. McCoy convinced Abilene that its destiny lay with cattle. Facilities on the order of loading pens and drovers' hotels were established, and none too soon, for the cattle were now coming in the thousands. The Annus Mirabilis was 1866. Some think as many as 250,000 Texas cattle were driven north in that year, some 80 to 90 herds. Kansas felt the brunt of all those hooves, a mixed delight, but Kansas was not alone. In that year, Charles Goodnight and Oliver Loving, with an eye to the Colorado rather than the Kansas markets, made their famous drive across the Pecos and opened the Goodnight Loving Trail. No less daring was Nelson Story, who, the same year, defied the U.S. Army and a number of Indian nations and took his first herd into Montana. It was soon apparent that Mr. Story had gotten ahead of his time, or at least of his place. Not for almost a decade and a half, until Custer had fallen and been revenged, did driving cattle to Montana become practical and popular. From 1866, for slightly more than a score of years, the Great Plains were alive with cattle, most of them longhorns pushed out of the South Texas brush. Abilene and Dodge City were the Athens and the Rome of that migration, but tributaries of cattle were constantly breaking loose from the central channel, and most of the tributaries flowed north to the fresh pastures of Nebraska and the Dakotas, Wyoming, Montana, or into Canada. 20 years is not long. The mid-60s soon became the mid-80s, at which point the flow of cattle was unabated. In 1886, John Blocker, the business-minded brother of the famous trail boss Ab Blocker, was said to have an interest in 82,000 cattle, all of them on the move at once in various herds along various trails. A mere 4 years later, it was over. A few herds were trailed north after that, but the activity had already become a romantic anachronism. By 1890, the year of Wounded Knee, trail driving on any serious scale had become as much a thing of the past as Indian fighting. The speedy 20th century was in sight. Railroads spanned the continent, and barbed wire spanned the Great Plains. The open range, that world of grass of a limitlessness that forever held the imagination of all who saw it, moving observer after observer to oceanic imagery in their attempts to describe it adequately, closed abruptly behind the last struggling herds, never to open again. The golden age of cowboying had passed, and its long silver age began. The trail drives and the wide-open cow towns they spawned were almost solely responsible for the myth of the cowboy, perhaps one should say of the Westerner, which remains potent to this day. The Westerner merges two figures, the cowboy and the gunfighter, in real life rarely the same breed, though most cowboys wore guns and many gunfighters herded cattle at one time or another. 100 years have now passed since the great herds filled the plains. The range closed, the cow towns became sedate, an urban age ensued. Yet even now, movie studios are still releasing major westerns. A year or two ago, President Reagan presented the first Congressional Gold Medal ever given a rider by our government to Louis L'Amour, author of more than 100 westerns. Even more recently, Fortune magazine singled out the Marlboro Man ads as being, from an advertiser's point of view, the most successful set of images ever presented to the buying public. The vigorous and tenacious myth didn't grow out of ranch life, with its repetitive and largely unromantic round of calving and fencing, feeding livestock and doctoring them. It grew out of those brief years when the West was unfenced and cattle, men, and horses were on the move. Few enough of the tens of millions of words and images that have been devoted in the last 100 years to depictions or dramatizations of Western life describe trail driving per se, but the drives were the generative activity without which most of the words would not have been written, or most of those images cast. Mining was also a potent activity in many parts of the West for many years, and yet the scattering of books and films about mining seemed minute when compared with the vast corpus of work that accrued around the cowboys and the gunmen who followed them along the cow trails and into the cow towns. The growth of the myth undoubtedly owed much to the birth of the film industry, even as the range was closing. The eminent film historian Siegfried Krakauer, in his Theory of Film, argues that chases are one of the most intrinsically cinematic of all subjects. In support of his argument, he quotes Robert Flaherty, who said, "People never get tired of seeing a horse gallop across the plains." The success of hundreds of crudely acted, clumsily plotted westerns, offering little more than the innate eye appeal of speeding horses juxtaposed against a vast plain, would seem to bear Flaherty out. Without the romantic conception of the cowboy engendered by the drives, there would have been less occasion for the careers of William S. Hart, Tom Mix, John Wayne, Clint Eastwood, and a host of other actors who rode to fame in the westerns. Without the drives, we would not have had The Long Trail, John Ford's silent masterpiece, would have had no Red River, no Rawhide, no Gunsmoke, no Johnson County or Lincoln County War, no gunfight at the OK Corral. The rich iconography of the gunfighter derived from the marshals and outlaws who filled the cowtowns. Behind Marshal Dillon were such colorful men as Bear River Tom Smith, First Marshal of Abilene, James Butler, Wild Bill Hickok, the Earps, Bat Masterson, and others. The romance of outlawry in America owed much to the Range Wars. Billy the Kid, the Wild Bunch, Tom Horn, and a host of minor banditti whose exploits are all but forgotten, left legends that have fed our popular culture for a century now. Curiously enough, most of the great gallery of cattlemen who peopled the industry in the golden years of trail driving have been largely ignored by the films, the television series, and the pulp westerns. Charles Goodnight's career would have made a great role for John Wayne, any stage of his career, at any stage of Wayne's, but it didn't happen. Little has been done with Shanghai Pierce, Charles Sringo, Teddy Blue, Uncle Dick Wooten, the Marquis de Moras, or Teddy Roosevelt's cowboy years. That colorful talker, Ab Blocker, who in the judgment of his contemporaries drank water out of more cow tracks and pointed more cattle toward the North Star than any other man, survives only in a short sketch by J. Frank Dobie and a few brief tributes in The Trail Drivers of Texas, by far the most important collection of first-hand narratives by the trail-driving cowboys. The places, or at least the place names, have fared better. Some fairly ordinary rivers and some distinctly meager villages have enjoyed a resonance, in legend, far out of proportion to their size or appeal. Place names are all in the way of poetry that many people ever experience, much less create, and the West produced some wonderful ones, the Pecos, the Cimarron, the Purgatory, or, to many cowboys, the Picket Wire, the Red, Powder River, Crazy Woman Creek, the Stinking Water, Dodge City, Abilene, Ogallala, Deadwood, Tombstone, and many more. Whoever thought up Boot Hill as a name for a cemetery had the poetic spark. The power of place names is a mostly unstudied literary phenomenon, but writers from Homer on have felt it. In this regard, if in no other, Western writers are well equipped. In attempting to assess how it is that the trail driving experience produced a romantic model, the Westerner, whose potency lasted a century, we should hearken for a bit to the trail hands themselves. What did they think about their time on the trail? Almost unanimously, they regarded it as the happiest and most satisfying experience of their lives. Over and over again, in memoirs, they speak of how wonderful it was, the beautiful, unspoiled country, the excellent horses, their fine comrades. They mentioned the loyalty they felt for their outfits, the excitement of crossing the endless plains, the trivial nature of their hardships in the light of all the fun they had, the thrill of arriving at some prairie sodom where their small wages were usually quickly squandered. Few of these memoirs were more eloquent. Instead, they were grindingly sincere, even sanctimonious. The last quality particularly irked Teddy Blue, never sanctimonious himself. He thought the cowhands who contributed to the Trail Drivers of Texas sounded like a bunch of preachers, which was not how he remembered them. Just reading the table of contents of that book reveals the sober attitude with which the contributors approached their task. A thorny experience, 7 trips up the trail, the good old cowboy days, made a long trip to Wyoming, trail driving to Kansas and elsewhere, preferred to take older cattle up the trail. For all the sobriety of its short, prosaic accounts, the book is irreplaceable, and invariably the most eloquent passages in the, for the most part, homely literature of the trail are expressions of regret that it all ended, that the open range closed, that the settlements came, that their comrades are gone. Teddy Blue's valedictorian at the end of We Pointed Them North, 1939, in my view, the single best book about the trail driving experience, is better put than most, but identical in its imagery to many others on the same theme. A man has got to be at least 75 years old to be a real old cowhand. I started young, and I'm 78. Only a few of us are left now, and they're scattered from Texas to Canada. The rest have left the wagon and gone ahead across the big divide, looking for a new range. I hope they find good water and plenty of grass, but wherever they are is where I want to go. Many of the trail-driving cowboys were, in Olaf Stapledon's phrase, last and first men. That is, the last to do the work they did, and also the first to do it. Most of the cowboys were poor teenagers from Texas or other southern parts, youths whose prospects were dim until the cattle drive saved them from the slavery of the plow. Those who went in at 15 or 16 with the drives of 66 or 67 were only in their 30s when, 20 years later, the life began to die. Some of them saw both the beginning and the end, and then lived for 40 or 50 years in the shadow of what they felt to be an unmatchable experience. For their male children, the shadow of that experience was often heavy. No matter how skilled they got as cowboys, they could never go up the trail. The primal experience of their craft, and it was a craft they cherished deeply, had also been, in some haunting way, a terminal experience. Extremely intense experience is almost by definition brief, and so it was with trail driving. The cowboys well knew that the open country couldn't last. They saw the railheads moving west, saw the settlers moving with them. The paradox of their experience, a paradox of which the more thoughtful among them were keenly aware, was that in entering the open range, they hastened its closing. It was indeed their fate to be the men who killed the thing they loved. Of course, the plains were only virgin in their eyes. The Indians had lived on them for many generations. But by the time the trail drives were finished, so too were the Indians. And the movement of people and animals on the Great Plains would never again be easy and unobstructed as, for so long, it had been. The movement of people and animals is evidently a pleasing thing to be a part of, also a pleasing thing to contemplate and to watch. Robert Flaherty's simple remark that people never get tired of watching a horse galloping across the plains is surely one of the keys to understanding the vitality of the Western myth. The cowboys didn't walk those cattle north. They were not true nomads, but they benefited from the romance that attaches to nomadism, particularly if the nomads are horse people. The identification of cowboys with horses was immediate. In 1874, Joseph McCoy wrote that the reputation of Texas for horsemanship is national and needs no eulogiums in this place. The cowboys swiftly joined the ranks of renowned horse people, which include the Huns, the Cossacks, the Bedouin, and the Plains Indians, all of which have been good box office in romantic art, fiction, and film. The trail drives produced a body of imagery that speaks of movement without constraint. Images of movement on horseback suggest a degree of freedom for which a great many hemmed-in people yearn. There is no evidence that cowboys were more free or more emotionally effective than anyone else. In many respects, they were patently ineffective and not at all free. But that is realism, and the cowboy belongs to romance. However they may have felt as living men, they function in our urban and suburban culture as symbols of freedom, a simpler, more satisfying, less constrained way of life. As the cities spread, urban figures, space cowboys a la Star Wars, super agent gunfighters a la James Bond, may partially replace them, but the replacement will only be partial. The trail drives only began to end 100 years ago. The thunder of all those hooves, the jingle of all those spurs, has not entirely faded. For a while yet, the cowboy, his hat thrown back and his spurs still a-jingling, his face filled with a glow and a glee as he contemplates the sea of grass, will go on riding through our lives.
And that concludes this week's edition of Texas Monthly, dedicated to articles written about Texas writer Larry McMurtry. We hope you'll listen next week as we'll present one more episode of Texas Monthly Archives, dedicated to articles written about Larry McMurtry.
That's all the time we have for this edition of Texas Monthly Archives. We invite you next week to once again hear recording library volunteers and staff read articles from the files of the National Magazine of Texas.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, Senior Notes, followed by the History Book Hour at 9. Friday on the Noon Book Hour, we begin Larry McMurtry's first novel, Horsemen Pass By, published in 1962. In this stunning literary debut, Horsemen Pass By exhibits the full-blooded Western genius that would come to define McMurtry's incomparable sensibility. In the dusty North Texas town of Thalia, young Lonnie Bannon quietly endures the pangs of maturity as a persistent rivalry between his grandfather and step-uncle, Hud, festers, and a deadly disease spreads among their cattle like wildfire. Horsemen Pass By, written by Texas author Larry McMurtry, starting Friday at noon and Saturday at 2 a.m. on Recording Library of West Texas Radio. Read by listening.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 65 and clear. Tonight, partly cloudy with a low in the low 50s. Then tomorrow, partly cloudy with a high in the upper 60s. Tomorrow night, it will be cloudy with a low in the upper 50s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 8 p.m.
Good cheer your way. folks, I'm Jeff Bressler, turning on the lights of the Make-Believe Ballroom and welcoming you into my crystal studio for another program of the great hits of the 1930s and 1940s. I'm hosting the show to keep the music and traditions of past hosts, Martin Block, Al Jarvis, William B. Williams, and the legendary Steve Allen alive. Whether you're one of my longtime listeners or a new listener on public broadcasting or community radio stations across the U.S., grab your dance ticket, it's free, and let's reminisce. Hello world, and from coast to coast on public, university, and community radio stations, welcome, welcome, welcome to the Make-Believe Ballroom, and thanks for joining me this hour as I share some wonderful swing, jazz, and big band music, and many of the stories behind the records and the personalities who recorded them. Hope you're all doing well. A special kind of ballroom today as we look at a very special component of big bands of the era, that being ensemble vocals. In the early 1940s, ensemble vocals became an important feature of some of the most popular songs of the day. There was Frank Sinatra with the Pied Pipers fronting the Tommy Dorsey Orchestra, Ray Eberle with the Modernaires and the Glenn Miller Orchestra, and Dick Hames with the Song Spinners. They were three of the best known and most popular of these groups. But there was also a fourth major ensemble. The fourth ensemble was a bit different and most unique. Both parts of that group were stars of the biggest magnitude in their own right, and they combined to produce, in my estimation, what became some of the most enjoyable music of the 1940s. I'd like you throughout the show today to think who they might have been, and I'll let you know in our grand finale. Now, the concept of vocal group backups to the big bands was nothing new, and it could be traced all the way back to Paul Whiteman in the late 1920s. Bing Crosby and Al Rinker, they were very close friends, and they had been together in a jazz band in Spokane, Washington, while they were both in college. Now, that jazz band became so popular that the two, they dropped out of college, and they mounted Rinker's Model T to drive to Los Angeles, where Rinker's sister, the legendary Mildred Bailey, who was a great jazz singer, was working at the time. Now, shortly after they arrived in L.A., they landed a gig on the vaudeville circuit as a vocal act. As luck had it, some members of Paul Whiteman's orchestra were in attendance and caught their act and recommended them to Paul Whiteman, who hired them in October of 1926. So Bing and Al traveled to Chicago to hook up with the Whiteman Orchestra, where they made their first records. So the initial successes for Bing and Al with Whiteman were followed by a disaster when they reached New York, and they couldn't be heard in the large Paramount Theater. I mean, obviously, speaker systems in the late 1920s probably left a huge amount to be desired. So as a solution, they added Harry Barris to the duo, and that made all the difference to the act, and Paul Whiteman's Rhythm Boys were born. The additional voice of Barris meant that Al Rinker and Bing Crosby could now be heard more easily in the large New York theaters, and they quickly became a huge success. The trio sang in three-part harmony, with both Rinker and Barris also playing the piano. So, Jeff, enough with the talking. I want to hear the Rhythm Boys, and well you will, my dear listeners. Here for your enjoyment, on Victor, Side by Side, Paul Whiteman and his orchestra, vocal by the Rhythm Boys, recorded in New York City, April the 29th, 1927.